He wrote it, he says, while he was sitting on the roof of a building at Cambridge University. I heard him personally say that at Cambridge University in 1984. He claimed that the faculty there were taking turns watching out for the Nazi bombers. And while he was there sitting on the roof doing his thing, he wrote The Road to Serfdom. It's probably a big story or a tall tale, but that's what he said. And the theme of it, of course, is Hayek was alarmed that many of the exact same policies that had been adopted by the totalitarian fascists of his day, Hitler and Mussolini and so forth, were being adopted by the democracies, especially England. They were not adopting concentration camps and that sort of thing, but economic policy-wise and with respect to civil liberties and the rule of law, he saw some of the same things happening in the democracies that had happened very, very quickly in the fascist world of his time. And so it's a classic warning that you don't need totalitarianism to go down the road to serfdom. And in this regard, it's sort of similar to one of the things that Friedrich Bastiat said in his famous book, The Law, which everyone should read, by the way. If you're interested in this topic, you should read The Law if you never have, by Bastiat. It's online. And one of the points he made is that you can have the same results under socialism and under democracy. If under democracy, the public is persuaded to vote for some sort of central plan to be imposed by force on the entire society, well, then you have a version of totalitarian socialism, although it occurs under democracy. And so I think, and that's, Hayek doesn't cite Bastiat in that regard, but he makes a very similar argument. When I read or reread The Road to Serfdom, I'm reminded of that. And so I want to start with one of the quotations from The Road to Serfdom in the chapter one on the abandoned road. And Hayek is talking about how it is that Germany, of all places, Germany was once a bastion of classical liberalism, of libertarian ideas. And so he's writing about how it is that there were a lot of well-known European liberals from Germany whose ideas sort of vanished and their influence vanished. And in a very quick amount of time, in about 20 years' time, how did this happen? He says, for at least the last 25 years, before the specter of totalitarianism became a real threat, we had progressively been moving away from the basic ideas on which Western civilization has been built. That this movement on which we have entered with such high hopes and ambitions should have brought us face to face with the totalitarian horror has come as a profound shock to this generation, which still refuses to connect the two facts, that is, the abandonment of these ideas and the adoption of totalitarianism. Yet this development merely confirms the warnings of the fathers of the liberal philosophy which we still profess. Of course, the word liberal in Europe today, even today, still means more or less libertarian. In America, it means the opposite. And then to continue on with the quote, we have progressively abandoned that freedom in economic affairs without which personal and political freedom has never existed in the past. Although we have been warned by some of the greatest political thinkers of the 19th century, by Tocqueville and Lord Acton, that socialism means slavery, we have steadily moved in the direction of socialism. And then in the previous page, he says, he remarks that although until 1931, England and America had followed only slowly on the path on which others had led, even by then, they had moved so far that only those whose memory goes back to the years before the last war, that is World War I, know what a liberal world has been like. And so what Hayek is saying here is that one of the reasons why Europe had a relatively free society for a long, long time in most of the countries of Europe was that it was preceded by and it was supported by a culture of ideas known as liberalism. And then also the way in which totalitarianism came about was a prerequisite for that was the abandonment of those ideas. And of course, the public didn't just willy-nilly abandon those ideas. This was a result of a concerted effort or a concerted campaign to denigrate, demean, criticize these ideas and the people espousing those ideas. So in a sense, The Road to Serfdom is an optimistic book in that the message is that if the culture of ideas can be changed around in the direction of freedom, then there's hope for societies to become more free and less despotic as well. And so Hayek, in that sense, was a bit of an optimist. And so I thought it would be useful, one of the reasons why I put on the reading list for the course several chapters of Liberalism by von Mises, is that this is the clearest exposition that I know of the abandoned road that Hayek is talking about. The ideas of the abandoned road. And I also, you might notice, put an article by Benito Mussolini on the reading list. And Mussolini was a PhD in philosophy. He had a PhD in philosophy. He fancied himself as an intellectual. And he understood this point. He understood, as did the other totalitarians of the day, they understood that the ideas of liberalism had to be smashed before they could do what they wanted to do and establish totalitarian rule. And so in Mussolini's writings, he uses the words classical liberalism, and he's very harshly critical of it. And in its place, he says we should adopt fascism. And the slogan of fascism was always some version of the common good before self-interest. That was the slogan of Italian fascism, and that was the slogan of German fascism and all other varieties of fascism. And there were always, any of the varieties of fascism or socialism always attacked individualism, or the idea of individualism, while promoting fascism. And the ideas of liberalism, or individualism rather, are also mentioned by Hayek. In a very simple explanation about individualism, there's always been a lot of confusion about this by a lot of people about what individualism means. You know, does it mean greed, selfishness, and so forth? Well, here's what Hayek said about it. The essential features of that individualism, which from elements provided by Christianity and the philosophy of classical antiquity, was first fully developed during the Renaissance and has since grown and spread into what we know as Western civilization. And so what are these principles? The principles are, quote, the respect for the individual man, qua man, that is, the recognition of his own views and tastes as supreme in his own sphere, however narrowly that may be circumscribed, and the belief that it is desirable that men should develop their own individual gifts and bents. Period. Respect for the individual. Tolerance is also a big part of that. He says, tolerance is perhaps the only word which still preserves the full meaning of the principle which during the whole of this period was in the ascendant and which only in recent times has again been in decline to disappear completely with the rise of the totalitarian state. And so that's what individualism meant to Hayek and to the liberals, the classical liberals. It didn't mean all the various things that the enemies of freedom say it means. It just simply means respect for the individual and acknowledgement that the individual's views of his or her tastes and preferences ought to be supreme when it comes to the economy. And so what were these the main ideas? I think it's worth just rattling them off or briefly discussing the main ideas of liberalism. The abandoned road. What was abandoned? Well, first of all, private property. Ludwig von Mises wrote in Human Action and elsewhere, and also in his book Liberalism, about the importance of property to freedom, and that with private property, it gives people a sphere of activity apart from the government. If you can own property, if you can own your home, you can own your business, you can own yourself, you can make a living for yourself and not be dependent on the state. And so therefore, private property, including the property in yourself, in your own body, in your own mind, is indispensable as a means of becoming a self-sufficient human being who is not a ward of the state. And so it's not only something that would benefit the wealthy, the people who have the ability to accumulate great amounts of property. It's the poorest of the poor who most need a society in which the institution of private property exists. And one of the comments that Mises makes in the book Liberalism on this point is that, of course, there is no such thing as the public interest, the public good, the common good, because that implies unanimity. It's not the same as an 80% unanimity. 80% or 90% is not the same as the common good. The common good means unanimous consent. But one of the points that Mises makes is that the closest you can come to talking of using this kind of language, the public good, the public interest, is not individual public policies, but institutions such as private property, that you can make a case that a society that protects and enforces private property rights is one that will benefit everyone in the society from doing so. And so that's one example of how Mises thought that this whole talk about the public interest, the public good, makes sense, but it doesn't make sense in talking about legislation of any kind. Okay, so private property. Freedom in general is the main idea of what is known as liberalism. And over the years in my writings, one of the things I've learned is that, as you can imagine, people like myself who do a lot of writing on the internet and even before the internet, in public and popular books and popular articles and things, like, get a lot of mail. And of course, with the internet, it's easy to get a lot of mail from all over the world. And most of it is friendly. But we all get hate mail from statists, but the one thing that triggers the most hateful hate speech directed at me is whenever I write something that defends peaceful freedom of enterprise. Yeah, you write an article that defends the peaceful exchange of goods and services among consenting adults, and there's a good chance you'll get some extraordinarily hateful emails from all over the world, too. I once persuaded a friend of mine who had two young daughters to write an article about a game, a child game that she told me about. It was roller coaster something, roller coaster, some kind of business game. I remember the word roller coaster was in it. Maybe Cam could find it. Her name was Pat Smith, and she did write it in Mises.org about 10 years ago. Tycoon, that's a roller coaster tycoon. And so it's a child's game. It's about business, you know, how to be a business person. And so the article came out on Mises.org, and she told me when the next time I saw her, never again will I take your advice and write an article for Mises.org. You wouldn't believe the hate mail I got, because she was arguing that maybe it's a good idea for kids like her 10 and 12-year-old daughters to learn a little bit about the business world. And, oh, my God, the vitriol that was directed at her for suggesting that children should consider becoming capitalists. And that's general. I've found the same thing to be true in the years that I've been writing on these subjects. And so freedom has to have a champion. Hayek himself was one, and he mentioned Lord Acton and people of that sort that were so influential in Europe prior to his day. Peace is the third element of liberalism. All of you should read the famous article, War is the Health of the State, by Randolph Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E. It's online. And also, if you're interested in this, the works of Robert Higgs, especially his book, Crisis and Leviathan. But Bob Higgs has written many, many articles on the web, too, on the subject of how war, even to the victors, always destroys a large degree of liberty and prosperity. Even if a country wins the war, they still lose a lot of personal liberty and a lot of capital stock that had been accumulated with the purpose of serving the consumers. Okay, and so peace is an important ingredient of what is mean by liberalism. Equality under the law is another tenet. This means that the law should be one, clear, so that the citizens can understand what is legal and what is not. And it should apply equally to everyone, including the rulers, including the politicians. And of course, that doesn't always apply. But that's a principle of liberalism, equality under the law. Another principle is inequality of income is desirable because it's based on the international division of labor. It's based on the recognition that all human beings are unique. We're all different. We all have different interests, different skills, different abilities, different intelligence levels, and so forth, and a thousand other biological differences among human beings. And so it's not natural to think that equality of income is even desirable. And so, the acceptance of inequality of income is a natural thing. In one of my favorite short Murray Rothbard articles is on this topic from his book, Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Nature, where he lays out some of the arguments against egalitarianism or government-enforced equality of outcomes, government-enforced equality of income, basically. And so that was always a tenet of liberalism. But that too went by the wayside in Europe during Hayek's day. Tolerance and free speech is also very important. John Stuart Mill was famous for writing about this among the European liberals of the 19th century. And also in The Road to Serfdom, Hayek mentions how all socialists of all kinds, whether they're called fascists, communists, or whatever, always attacked free speech in some degree. Because one aspect of collectivism, whether it is called socialism or fascism or anything else, is the imposition of some sort of government plan, one unitary government plan for the entire society. And that's difficult, if not impossible, to do if the people can criticize the plan and block it by influencing public opinion. And so the liberals, the European liberals of Hayek's day and before Hayek's day, were also champions of tolerance and free speech. And the role of government, Hayek himself was not an anarchist or an anarcho-capitalist, and neither was Ludwig von Mises. They were advocates of limited constitutional government. Hayek had high praise for the U.S. Constitution, as did Ludwig von Mises, as setting up essentially the right kind of government, a government that would be mostly decentralized under the original Constitution. Of course, the fatal flaw of the original U.S. Constitution was that it permitted slavery to exist. But in the post 1866 era, when there was no longer slavery, Mises and Hayek both admired that constitution by and large. Not every single word of it, but by and large they did. So they were not anarchists, and so the Constitution itself is a manifestation in many ways of the natural rights philosophy that was popular in Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries. And the role of government basically is to protect rights to life, liberty, and property. If we were to have government, the argument went, that's what government should be doing, protecting rights to life, liberty, and property. And sometimes you need collective action, the argument goes, to do that effectively. Sometimes you can't do it very well individually, the argument goes. And so these men, Hayek and Mises, were not anarchists or an anarcho-capitalist, which is not to say they might not have moved in that direction had they been alive today, had they lived and seen the failed project of limited constitutional government After all, von Mises died in 1973. Hayek died, I don't know, 15 years later or so. But we don't know that they might have changed their mind. Even Milton Friedman, in his latter years, long after he retired from academia, became, I wouldn't say an abolitionist of the Fed, but I would say he did go on television and say that we might be better off if the Fed had not existed. I guess you could call that an abolitionist. He didn't say that while he was a professor at Chicago, but I did hear him say that with my own ears on television in his later years. And so he changed. And in fact, Friedman's most famous book is Capitalism and Freedom, or one of his most famous books, I guess, written in the 60s. And then he and his wife, Rose, who also co-authored that book, wrote Free to Choose in 1980. And in the preface, he says that one of the big differences between the two books, they were both their personal statements of their version of economic freedom. But one of the big changes, he said, was he learned a lot about political economy in the meantime, or otherwise known as public choice. And it made him much more of a pessimist about government than he was in the 1960s. And so you can make an argument or entertain the thought that Mises and Hayek would have changed their ideas too, and they might have become more more radical had they lived to 150. Okay, and so Hayek does also start in The Road to Serfdom talking about the link between economic and political freedom. And if I can find the quote, and here it is. He talks about this in the Abandoned Road chapter. He says he's talking about Europe and the European economy of the 19th, early 20th century. He says the gradual transformation of a rigidly organized hierarchic system into one where men could at least attempt to shape their own life, that is, from feudalism to capitalism, where man gained the opportunity of knowing and choosing between different forms of life, is closely associated with the growth of commerce, capitalism. From the commercial cities of northern Italy, the new view of life spread with commerce to the west and north, through France and the southwest of Germany, to the Low Countries, and to the British Isles, taking firm root wherever there was no despotic political power to stifle it. That's the important part of the sentence. The growth of commerce in all throughout Europe took, quote, firm root wherever there was no despotic political power to stifle it. And so as long as governments were either in a state of turmoil or unable or unwilling to meddle or interfere with commerce, well, that's where commerce thrived the most, when they didn't tax and regulate it out of business. Some things never change. And this was also associated with the fact that several hundred years ago, Europe was much more decentralized than it is now. There were city-states, many, many hundreds of city-states at one point in European history. And then, centralization gradually took place over the decades, over the centuries, so that the configuration of the European map as we see it today is nothing at all like it was 200 or 300 years ago. And, classical liberals, long before Hayek, understood that this highly decentralized system of many, many, governments was one of the key ingredients of the growth of capitalism, the growth of commerce. Because if one state was hostile toward commerce, people could very easily go and live in another state that was more friendly to commerce. But in a scenario where there's one big super state, such as the European Union, well, that can be a monopoly government that can create uniform regulations and taxes, and there can be no competition between the states. And that, of course, is the whole idea of the European Union, is to create a big monopoly government for the sake of growing government everywhere. And so they've gone just the opposite of what old Europe did and of what was the source of the success of capitalism in Europe. And another big theme of all of Hayek's writing including the first several chapters of The Road to Serfdom, is the idea of spontaneous order of markets. And this is basically the idea of Adam Smith's invisible hand. And one of the best and most famous expositions of this idea is the essay I, Pencil by Henry Hazlitt. And I put a much more sophisticated version of it on the readings for tonight in the form of Hayek's article, The Use of Knowledge in Society. There was an article in the New Yorker magazine in the early 90s, I believe it was. It was about Hayek. It was called The Price Prophet, and prophet spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T, The Price Prophet. And I was shocked to read this article years ago because a journalist made the point that this article, written in 1946, The Use of Knowledge in Society, essentially anticipated the internet and the use of knowledge in society by the internet, and how it would transform, how computers and the internet would transform commerce and much of society in general. And so the article was entitled The Price Prophet. It held up Hayek as some kind of prophet. And of course, this wasn't really his idea. This Adam Smith wrote about this. People before Adam Smith wrote about the whole idea of, you know, answering the question, well, how is it that we get our milk and our bread and the things that we enjoy in our daily life without anyone being in charge, without any czar telling us how much milk we need, how much bread we need, and so forth? Well, it's because of the pursuit of rational self-interest in a market economy that allows private property and free market prices, whereas the only way to make a living is to serve your fellow man. One of the famous quotes from the Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith that Hayek mentions on a few occasions in The Road to Serfdom is, I can paraphrase it, that what capitalism means is this: give me that which I want, and I will give to you that which you want. That's capitalism in a sentence. That's what capitalism is. And so it's the human nature of the pursuit of self-interest within a rule of law, Hayek would say, within a rule of law with laws and moral codes prohibiting theft and fraud and that type of behavior, that at least minimize that type of behavior and that create respect for private property. This is a system that works. And so this is one of the things Hayek argues that was forgotten, that we don't need a planner. We don't need a central planner to tell us how much steel to produce, how many homes to manufacture. In the free market, the consumer is sovereign, and the only way to make money is to please the consumer. Ludwig von Mises was very good on this in the chapter of Human Action on the Market, where he makes the point that, yes, if the corporate executives and the bankers who seem to be in charge of the economy, but it's really the consumer who's in charge, because no matter how much money you have, if a better product comes about tomorrow, the consumer is full of whims, von Mises said. He's very whimsical, and he will drop you cold tomorrow for the newer, better, cheaper product, and you are bankrupt. And so, it's only the outward appearance that the CEOs and the bankers have all the power. It's really the customer, the consumer, that has the power. Now, Hayek is, his knowledge problem is what he is most famous for in economic circles. And the idea goes something like this, it's the same idea as in expressed in the essay I, Pencil, that in any economy, if you take something as simple as a pencil or a pizza, let's say, when you think about it, no human beings, no group of, say, 100 human beings could possibly produce something as simple as a pizza. Because when you think of the basic fundamental ingredients, what do you need? Well, you have to start with a wheat field, a farm that grows wheat, that is transformed into flour, that is transformed into dough for the pizza. And so just that, you need a farm, and you need the farm equipment. You need the engineering that goes along with the farm equipment. You need the gasoline that powers the trucks and the tractors. So therefore, you need a petroleum industry, and you need petroleum engineers and everything that goes along with that. And so when you think about it, the creation of a simple item like a pizza involved the efforts of hundreds or thousands of people from all over the planet who cooperate and collaborate because it is in their economic self-interest to do so. It's how they make a living, it's how they support themselves, it's how they support their families, and so forth. And there's nothing magical about it, there's nothing invisible about it, it's the invisible hand. It's human nature, it's how the economic world works, and it's all based on the international division of labor. We all specialize in something or some things, and in a market economy, we make money doing those things or running a business. And then we use that money as a medium of exchange to purchase goods and services from people who specialize in other things. That's what makes the economic world go around. Contemporary economists foolishly call this asymmetric information, and they condemn it as market failure. But asymmetric or different information in the minds of different human beings is what makes markets work. It's not what makes them fail. That's sort of a footnote. And so in the very first chapters, Hayek talks about spontaneous order of markets and the knowledge problem, and he comes back to it over and over again throughout The Road to Serfdom, because it was a big part of his life's work in his intellectual work, starting, I guess, with his famous essay, The Use of Knowledge in Society. And this is why planning took hold, totalitarian planning. He argues that the idea of spontaneous order of markets was forgotten. People forgot this. On the whole issue of freedom, now, Hayek in the first chapters makes note of the fact that there are different definitions of freedom. The original definition of freedom by the natural rights theorists and also by the American founders who wrote these ideas into the U.S. Constitution is known in political circle or philosophical circles as negative freedom, freedom from control by government. That's why in the original United States Constitution, much of it reads that government shall make no law doing this. You know, the Second Amendment that protects the right to bear arms, and the First Amendment that guarantees the right of free speech says Congress shall make no law. And so it was all so-called negative freedom that allowed people the a largest sphere possible to engage in their own to live their own lives and engage in commerce and to raise their families and just live as long as they respected the equal rights of everybody else in society. And so that was negative freedom. And then Hayek points out that an insidious thing happened. One of the things that he argues made the rise of totalitarianism possible and a chief part of his warning to the democracies about serfdom, about the road to serfdom, was a different type of freedom idea was invented and is known as positive freedom. And this type of freedom, a good example of it, was if you look up on the web, Franklin D. Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights, which he gave a speech, FDR gave a speech on the Economic Bill of Rights. And it's very different than negative freedom. It's so-called rights, meaning you supposedly have a right to a house. You supposedly have a right to a car. You supposedly have a right to a good paying job. And of course, that right is to be enforced by government. And so, you know, two different versions of freedom. One says that the role of government, if we are to have government, is to protect life, liberty, and property. The other one, positive freedom, so-called, the Franklin Roosevelt version, says the role of government is to tax one group of citizens so that other citizens can have houses and cars and jobs and whatever politicians would want to put on this list of so-called rights that people have, whether it's health care or anything else, 3 Mercedes per household, whatever it might be. And so that's the idea of so-called positive freedom, which is very different than negative freedom. And of course, Hayek is harshly critical of that. And so I think Cam was probably, there it is, Second Bill of Rights from Wikipedia on the chat. Another important point that he makes is that socialism, fascism, communism are all forms of collectivism. So Hayek didn't really distinguish much between fascism, socialism, communism. And if you read the book, he points out that all of the fascists, Mussolini, Hitler, they all started out as socialists. But the fascists decided that it would be to their political advantage to add nationalism to their socialism. And so they were national socialists, whereas the Russians were international socialists, or they claimed to be international socialists. But they were all socialists. And what was socialism? Of course, it started out being defined as government ownership of the means of production. That changed under fascism. The fascists said, well, yes, we're socialists, and the ostensible goal of this was egalitarianism. Socialism was always sold in the name of equality or pursuing equality, and the means, the people were told, of achieving this was government takeover of the means of production. The fascists were different, and they said, we will allow private ownership. However, it will be very heavily regimented, regulated, and controlled by us, by the government, and it will pursue whatever we say is in the public interest. So consumer sovereignty was abandoned, and the role of government would be to make sure that industry, even though privately owned, would be all government controlled. And so they set up a tremendous bureaucracy to try to achieve this. And so there's two different versions of socialism. The first was government ownership of the means of production. The second was fascism, private ownership but government control. That's a version of socialism or collectivism, as Hayek says. And then there's a third version. In the 1976 edition of The Road to Serfdom, in the preface that Hayek wrote, he mentioned that this very point, that the original definition of socialism was government ownership of the means of production. But then that changed. That changed over the years to mean essentially the redistribution of income through the auspices of the welfare state and progressive income taxation. And so the democracies adopted socialism without nationalizing very many industries. Now in Britain, they did nationalize the commanding heights, the steel industry, the coal industry, telephone, airlines, and so forth. But they didn't need to do that to have socialism as defined by Hayek. And so he defined it basically as the institutions of the welfare state coupled with a progressive income tax as being socialism. It's all a form of collectivism, he says. And as we go on and get into more detail in what Hayek says in The Road to Serfdom, we'll talk about his criticisms of the welfare state. Although he was an advocate of some welfare. Okay. He does a good job in the first chapters of The Road to Serfdom also of writing about the folly of price controls, of government control of prices. And of course, if you want to, one of my old articles from Mises.org is, I think the title was 4,000 Years of Price Control. It's basically a short book review of a book of that title by two authors named Eamon Butler and Robert Schudinger. And if you want to read a good, an interesting historical book about the disasters of price control, or use it, some of you who are students, or use it for a term paper or something, that's a very good economic history book related to price controls. And I briefly reviewed it on Mises.org some years ago. And so, and now Hayek, as I said, he was not an anarchist or an anarcho-capitalist. And in The Road to Serfdom, he advocates, he makes the public goods argument for the government provision of public goods. He makes the standard argument that people will free ride and won't contribute voluntarily enough for such things as national defense. And so therefore, they should be forced to pay for it through taxes. So that's a very unliberal argument, but he makes it. He also makes a case for all sorts of interventions in terms of a welfare state. He talks about a benefit cost test for government regulation. So he's very utilitarian in that regard. And so he says this, he advocates, quote, a wide, unquestioned field for state activity. So Hayek was by no means a radical libertarian at the time he wrote The Road to Serfdom. He was quite the interventionist, but by today's standards, he would be very libertarian by compared to today's politicians, certainly, with a few exceptions like Ron Paul. But he was very different than von Mises, and certainly different than people like Rothbard in terms of what he thought the scope of government activity should be. This is in 1943, keep in mind. But I would argue that by the time he died 30 years later, he was not saying this. He was pulling back, and he was much less of an interventionist in his dying days, in his latter days of his life, than he was in 1943. Having learned a lot about the disasters of the welfare state. He does point out in this one chapter, he talks about government planning as, quote, a movement against competition. It's always against competition. Now, in his day, this is true. A lot of the economists of his time were critical of competition because they made arguments well, it's excessive duplication. You know, why do we have more than one automobile company? It's a waste of resources, they would argue. So why do we have more than one electric power company? Why do we have more than one water supply company in town? It's duplication of effort. And so, of course, this played into the hands of monopolists who wanted government-granted monopolies. They came to be known as the public utilities, or so-called natural monopolies, although there was nothing at all natural about them. They were all imposed on the public by governments. They did not evolve in the free market that way. There was never a monopoly that evolved in the utilities industry in the free market anywhere. They all came about that way by government fiat. And so in Hayek's exposition in this, I think it's the third chapter, and critiques of planning as a movement against competition, that's what he's referring to. Primarily, the so-called public utility movement that was very prevalent in the early part of the 20th century, which is when he was an active academic, just getting his career started in the post-World War I years. And he wrote quite a bit of it. And also, this led, there was not much of a difference between this and corporatism or fascism in Italy and Germany, where they granted basically monopolies to politically favored corporations, and then the government would have a heavy hand in controlling what they did. And if corporations lost money, they bailed them out. So bailouts were a very big component of European fascism from an economic perspective, and Hayek condemns this as well. And he finishes up this third chapter reiterating or repeating the case for political decentralization. And that's why the enemies of freedom always demonize political decentralization by calling it states' rights and linking it to slavery because of the word states' rights, at least primarily in the United States, is used to sort of insinuate that you must be a defender of slavery or a racist or something like that. But this is all a smokescreen. I think no one in today's world is talking about bringing back slavery, certainly. And so that when libertarians talk about decentralization or decentralized government, they're bringing back the old, age-old, ancient understanding that if we're going to have government, the more decentralized, the better, and the less monopolized, the better. And so that's what Hayek is talking about here. In several instances, he makes the case for political decentralization. And so on that score, I would recommend one book that's fairly recent on this. It's edited by Donald Livingston. It's called Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century. The book of essays, I have one chapter. Yuri Maltsev, who's a friend of the Mises Institute, has another chapter. And so, I think there are 8 or 9, maybe 10 essays in it, but it's Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century. And they all make the case for radical political decentralization. And it's not a new case, of course. The European liberals of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries and after that made the same case in their own words. And so that's the last thing Hayek gets into. So I think that's about what I had to say for tonight. I wanted to give an overview and maybe some background about Hayek and his ideas in The Road to Serfdom. And hopefully you'll keep in mind all throughout this discussion in this class, the relevance of all these things for today's world. Like I said in one of my blogs advertising the class, a couple of years ago when Glenn Beck had our friends Yuri Maltsev and Tom Woods on his television show on Fox News Channel to talk about The Road to Serfdom, the book went to number one in sales the next day. That's what gave me the idea of teaching this class a couple of years ago in the first place. Because obviously it hit a chord. A lot of people thought, wow, I need to read that book. It explains what's going on right now today, even though it was written in 1943. And so keep that in mind that, to some the extent to which a lot of these arguments are relevant today or can be used today. And also keep in mind that Hayek was a bit of an optimist, and he really did believe that ideas change the world and that there's probably about a 20-year lag between the public's acceptance of a particular set of ideas and the realization of those ideas in the world, in the political world. And so, because a lot of these classes that I teach, students kind of get depressed when we talk about, explain to them what governments do and how there's, sort of ultimate enemy of freedom. And that sometimes there seems to be no hope. But we do have counterexamples in the world of things changing around for the better. The Soviet Union did implode after all. It didn't create heaven on earth, but it certainly created something better. And there are other examples too. So maybe I'll quit there and see if there are some questions that I could attempt to answer in the chat or the Q&A. Okay, the course materials are all in the course. When you sign up for the course and you click on The Road to Serfdom on Mises.org and you enter your password, the online readings are all there. And also we've asked everyone to buy a copy of The Road to Serfdom. So it's not all online, in other words. Okay, feel free to throw questions out if you have any. Yeah, did I say iPencil was written by Henry Hazlitt? No, that was Leonard Reed, not Henry Hazlitt. I misspoke on that. Well, it's not mandatory that we have questions, especially with the first class. And I know, tomorrow is a holiday in the U.S., so which is probably why a lot of people haven't signed up yet. I may still get some more tomorrow or the next day, since the articles are archived. But I wouldn't expect you necessarily to have read anything much or to get into it too much on the first class. But I'll sit here and see if there's any questions. Matthew is asking, how did classical liberals like Mises and Hayek propose that a liberal government be funded? they're writing about the original American system that they wrote favorably of. The original American system was that there was no income tax. There was no income tax until the Lincoln administration imposed one on the northern states during the Civil War, but that ended a few years after the war, and then the income tax that we have now was not created until 1913, the year 1913. But before that, the federal government in the United States was funded by tariffs and land sale of land. And the local governments were taxed, they had various excise taxes on whiskey or or you know, sin taxes and various things like that, license fees. And so most of what government did in the early days of America was done by state and local governments. Even when George Washington became president, the U.S. government was tiny, and he was merely the chief administrator of a very small bureaucracy. Even at the outbreak of the American Civil War, the only contact the average American had with the federal government was through the post office, and he paid the equivalent of about $45 a year in federal taxes. And so that was the original system, and it was constitutional for many decades. The constitutional functions of government were funded for several generations based only on tariffs on imports, and there were debates over tariffs during this time because the Jeffersonians, who were much more libertarian, advocated what was called a revenue tariff. And the idea was a revenue tariff would be maybe 10 or 12% on average, enough to raise money to finance the constitutional functions of government, but not so much as to deter foreign trade. Whereas there were always protectionists also who wanted maybe a 40 or 50% tariff. Abe Lincoln was an uber protectionist. And the average tariff rate zoomed up to 50% during his administration and then stayed there for about the next 50 years in the United States. And so that won out. But that's how the original constitutional functions were funded. And since Hayek especially speaks so highly in quite a few of his books, not just The Road to Serfdom, I imagine that's what he would approve of most. Indirect taxes. In fact, one book on this, you know, my old professor, the late James M. Buchanan, who was one of my professors in graduate school 1,000 years ago, or so, back when the dinosaurs still roamed the earth, he wrote a book with Geoffrey Brennan entitled The Power to Tax. And they took on the mainstream of the economics profession in this book. And because the mainstream of the economics profession makes the case that the best tax system is something like a broad-based income tax that captures everybody. But Buchanan and Brennan made the opposite argument that, no, the tax system can and should be used to control government when government oversteps its bounds. Therefore, it's better to have a tax, if you're going to have a tax system, have a series of excise taxes that people, so that people can simply quit buying the things that are taxed. As a way of protesting what government is doing with that money. And so and they were denounced as fascists in the Economic Journal for right at the time when they wrote this book. But it was very similar to the arguments of the American founders, but written in the language of mainstream economics. And this book was published, I think, in the late 70s or early 80s, The Power to Tax is the title of it. Jack wants to know how murder and rape investigations would be paid for in an anarcho-capitalistic society through voluntary contributions on the part of the people. And besides that, the government does a horrible job in many cases with rape and murder investigations. Most cops in America are basically crime historians. They show up after the crime has taken place, and they take down a report, and then they use the report to lobby for more money for the cops. And so the television shows that show the police solving every crime in the world is all a fantasy. That's very rare that they do these things. But I would recommend an article called The Not So Wild Wild West by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill in the Journal of Libertarian Studies in 1979. And also an article by me in the Independent Review a couple of years ago entitled Violence in the American West, Myth versus Reality. That talks about how when the American West was basically a frontier and as settlers moved out to the Midwest and the West, there were no governments. There were no state governments, there were no police, but they all, the wagon trains and the mining camps, all set up their own constitutions, their own bylaws, and they hired private police, they hired private investigators, to do these things. And that all happened for many, many years before governments were even created. And of course, governments are always imperialistic. And so they take over all these functions. As they inevitably do, just try to do with just about everything. Jack is could insurance play a part in funding it. He probably has in mind Hans Hoppe's ideas. Hans Hoppe has written several very long articles on insurance companies as a way of financing national defense, or maybe even government murder investigations and things like that. I don't know. In today's world, insurance is so heavily regulated and controlled by the government, it would have to be a theorized setting of a laissez-faire or anarcho-capitalist society. And they certainly would do a better job than the current government does. One of the things you should do when you're entertaining questions like this is keep in mind if you're wondering what a stateless society would look like or would do, the appropriate comparison is not perfection. The appropriate comparison is compared to the way the government does it now. And if you look at that, and then even if we had no military in a stateless society, there would still, I would argue, be vastly less mass murder than goes on with a military that has access to trillions of dollars to create weapons of mass destruction. A stateless society would not be perfect. Human beings, being what they are, there will always be murder and rape and criminal behavior of all kinds. But the state has always been the major perpetrator. The theme of my article that I see Cam put a link up to on the chat was that, one, research tells us that all those cowboy movies that portray the American West as a violent society are untrue. It was a relatively peaceful society because everyone had a gun. The old situation in the movies where two guys ride into town, walk into the bank, and steal everyone's money and ride off while the population sits there with their knees buckling and tears coming out of their eyes. That never happened because everyone there was armed. And it was their money that was in the bank. How would it be that everyone there walking around the town carrying a gun would see two guys robbing their money, steal their money, and just let them go? That didn't happen very often, but where the real violence was the U.S. government's war on the Plains Indians, which lasted for 25 years. That was the real violence. Yeah, Cam is also recommending Hans Hoppe's book, The Myth of National Defense, which is an excellent book that addresses all these types of questions in tremendous detail. And also, I would, on this line, if any of you have questions like this, I would also recommend some of the books of Bruce Benton, and he's written on private law. And so look up Bruce Benton and on the privatization of law enforcement. And it's theoretical and historical, and it's a real eye-opening book about how things worked, how things operated before governments took them over in terms of law enforcement. The Enterprise of Law is one of the books by Bruce Benson. Let's see, Matthew is also asking, he says, I believe Hayek was not a proponent of natural law. Hayek was a utilitarian. He was not a big proponent of natural law. He said nice things on occasion, especially in his book, The Constitution of Liberty, about natural law. But he was a utilitarian. In The Road to Serfdom, he was, certainly. And so in The Road to Serfdom, for example, he does say that he has no principal objection to government regulation as long as it passes some sort of benefit-cost test, so as long as it's possible to have some sort of measurable benefits and costs. And if the benefits outweigh the cost, then the government should regulate, should do it. That's not a natural rights argument. That's an argument based on, pseudo-social science and benefit-cost analysis. And it's called the utilitarianism. It's a version of what is known as utilitarianism, which is very different from natural law. Yeah, Cam always does a great job. He's lightning fast in getting these articles on the links to these articles. Everybody does. Danny does a great job. Everybody associated with the Mises Academy is just unbelievably good at what they do. I'm not speaking about myself, of course, but Danny, Cam, and the rest. Okay. Let's see if there's anything on the Q&A. Cam was once called the Quickster. Which girlfriend was that, Cam? Okay, so it still is. Well, it looks like we're sort of running out of gas here, and so maybe we'll call it a night then. I don't see any more questions, but thanks for participating and enrolling in the class. It's still not too late for other people to enroll, since the lectures are all archived, as you know. You don't have to be sitting in front of your computer to take the class. You can archive them, and you do miss out on the Q&A, I suppose. But thanks again, and we'll see you next week.